Hey gang, are you a musician here in Austin? You're looking to make a recording? Well, let me tell you about this great panel going on tomorrow night, Wednesday, May 18th at 7 p.m. at Arlen Studios right here in Austin, Texas. Austin Music Foundation presents Recording Your Music, How, Where, Why. Features industry leaders from major Austin recording studios who will help you answer these questions and more. Panelists include Dwight Baker, Mark Hallman, Gina Font-Saez, Jacob Skilba, and I, Johnny Gowdy, will be moderating the panel. Just go to austinmusicfoundation.org to RSVP and to get more information.
And you may ask yourself, well, how did I get here?
It's time. How did I get here? And now here is your host, Johnny Gowdy.
All right. Hello, I'm Johnny. I'm your host. Welcome to the show. Start of a brand new week. I have a great show for you guys today. My guest is a music industry veteran and my old friend, Tom DeSavia. He just wrote a book with John Doe from X. It's called Under the Big Black Sun, A Personal History of L.A. Punk. Written by John Doe with Tom DeSavia and friends. These are all these people from that era telling their story. Who is it, you ask? Well, of course, it's John Doe, Xene Cervenka, both from X, Dave Alvin from the Blasters, Jane Wiedlin and Charlotte Caffey from the Go-Go's, Robert Lopez, who's also El Vez, you might know him, Mike Watt from the Minutemen, Henry Rollins, tons more. Tons of people from that scene all telling their stories. It's an amazing book, Under the Big Black Sun, A Personal History of L.A. Punk. I've known Tom for a long time. I knew him when he worked at ASCAP, when I was in Mr. Rocket Baby, and then when I was signed to Lars Ulrich's label under Elektra. He was one of the vice presidents. We ended up hanging out a bunch then, and that was a great time. We've stayed in touch ever since, and I got to say that through my career, through all the people that I've met in this business, and I met a lot of people in this business, and I've worked with a lot of people, Tom is easily one of the most honest people I've ever met, with the most integrity, and he's a real music fan. He's a real music fan. He even has a podcast where he plays records and has guests on. It's called Live from High Fidelity. His latest episode features John Bryan, the great musician. It's had Amy Mann on there, Sam Phillips on there, tons of people. The guy is just great. Tom DeSavia, we have a great conversation via Skype. You got to get this book, man. All these people telling their stories. I actually got it on audiobook because I was traveling the weekend before I did this, before we had this conversation. And they got every single person that wrote their story to tell their story on the audiobook. So when you listen to the audiobook, it's all these people. John Doe, Xene, Jane, Charlotte, Mike Watt, Henry Rollins, all these people, even more. Telling their story, and Tom's story is interwoven through there because he saw X when he was 15 years old in the 80s, and that's what inspired him to work in the music business. And then when he got to Elektra Records in the 90s, he ended up getting with X and putting out their box set, and he and John Doe became friends. And then imagine coming full circle, Tom and John sat down together and wrote and put together this beautiful book about this amazing scene from the late 70s and early 80s. It's called Under the Big Black Sun, A Personal History of L.A. Punk. All right, so my conversation with Tom is coming up. It's a great conversation via Skype. I think he was in his office in Los Angeles. I didn't even ask him where he was. We were just talking. He had a lot of whiskey behind him and a Mattel football, one of those little handheld Mattel football games, right behind him the whole time. And we finally talked about it after the thing. Great conversation with Tom, an inspiring story, a beautiful man, a great guy in this crazy, crazy business. He's one of my favorite people, all right? So before we get to that, before we get to my conversation with Tom, a couple weeks ago, Katie Rain was on the show, a pop group from here, Katie and her partner Ben. They are looking to raise some money. They started a GoFundMe page so that they can put out their EP. And you can find it at katierain.com. But Katie stopped by the other day, and we had a quick chat about the GoFundMe page and what they're up to and what they're trying to accomplish. So before we get to my conversation with Tom DeSavia, here's my quick conversation with Katie Rain.
I've been leaving voicemails. I wish that they would cut me off. I say all the wrong things just so no one to stop. But you've been leaving love notes.
So you're in the middle of moving?
Yes.
What?
It's terrible.
Where are you moving?
I'm moving in with one of my friends and coworkers because she's amazing. And right now our rent is a little high, even though, you know, I love where I live. Rent is eating up a very large portion of our monthly income.
Yeah.
Me being a poor working musician.
Yeah.
And so my coworker and my friend was like, okay, well, I have a room and you can have it for $400 a month.
Yeah.
And we're like, what? No, like, bills or nothing? She's like, no.
So you and Ben?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So you guys are going to move in.
Yeah.
And you guys are going to live with a third party?
Yeah.
Have you done that?
Oh, yeah. We live, there's six people in our house right now.
Oh, Jesus.
Yeah.
That's a lot of people.
It's fun.
So speaking of not having the funds, because you are a working musician.
Yes.
You are here to talk about a GoFundMe.
I am.
Campaign that you guys have started. You can find it at katierain.com. Tell me what's going on. Tell me how much you need to raise, by when, and what you're doing it for.
Oh, my gosh. Okay. So we started this GoFundMe because we have been working for the past 2 years so hard on this music project that we've started together, me and Ben. And we are asking for $5,000. We're already halfway there after just a week, which is incredibly amazing.
And that's $5,000. Not, they don't want you to run a certain amount of time.
Like, not five kangaroos
or
something,
or a 5K.
No. I mean, fitness is very important, but yeah. So we're raising $5,000. We're already halfway there. There's been such overwhelming support, and we're doing it. We've got production pretty much done, but we need help. We're making a music video the first weekend of June, and we are also going to distribute this. So the cost of printing and also making really cool Katie Rain t-shirts that are going to be new, and we want everyone to rock. And then we're also going to do some PR so that people can
You're
going to
hire
about
a publicist
it.
That's going to get help you get the word out, maybe get some print business for you. And
yes.
You can't get print or radio without a physical copy, and it costs a lot of money to do that.
Yeah.
Even though you're not going to make any money off of it, you need it to spend money to make money.
Yeah, it's true. It's one of those essential investments, and we were like, I don't know what we're going to do. Am I going to have to take a loan out? Am I going to have to like donate a leg or something? Cuz I'm okay with that. Like, I can rock, you know, just like a single leg. But we decided to go with the GoFundMe, and it's been an overwhelming success. And I can't thank everyone enough, but we're so close, and we're so excited to make this something that was just a dream a reality.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Making your dream come true.
Yeah.
I've heard the song, one of the songs from it. It's amazing.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you.
So are you guys playing any shows this summer? Do you guys have any big plans coming up this summer, live-wise, where people can see you even if they're in Austin?
Yeah, we're playing up in Cedar Park on the 20th, and then I forget the exact date because I'm awesome.
Well, that's good, because people can just go to katierain.com,
yes.
KadyRain.com, and go to the GoFundMe page, and also look on your calendar and find out when you're playing exact dates and everything.
Yeah, we'll be playing a Google Festival in June.
A Google
downtown.
Festival?
Yeah.
That's pretty cool.
I know.
That's pretty big time.
I know.
Did you guys sell out? Is that what that means?
No.
You guys aren't the humble
Katie
Rain.
We're just barely getting in. we're just getting started, so.
Well, I love what you guys do. I love your music. I'm going to support it. Everyone out there, do what you can. Go to katierain.com. Go support their GoFundMe page and help them get this EP made, video made, get the PR, get the distribution, and also new shirts that you can get.
Yeah. Thank you all. Love you. You.
Yeah. Get out there and help Katie Rain. Go to katierain.com. All right? Hey, before we get into this conversation with Tom DeSavio, I also want to remind you that this Friday, May 20th, here in Austin, Texas, at the 1-to-1 Bar, my friend Patrick Davis is having an art show and rock show. It's the Tasteless Nudes Art Show, with music by Sundown Revelry, Robert Johnson Soul, George DeVore, and he's got art by a lot of musicians. I know I'm putting in one of my paintings. It's called Cock City. I know AJ Vallejo's doing a piece too. So yeah, check it out. It's Friday, May 20th at the 1-to-1 Bar in Austin. I will not be here. I will be in Houston playing with Skyrocket. And then Saturday, I'm going to go see the Eagles of Death Metal. That's going to be exciting. All right. Let's talk to Tom DeSavia, whose new book, Under the Big Black Sun, A Personal History of L.A. Punk, written by John Doe with Tom DeSavia and friends. All right. This is a great, inspiring story. It's so beautiful. It's so exciting to go back and hear people wanting to change something. They were fighting against the system, against the status quo, trying to make things freaky and unique and artistic. And it's a really beautiful story, and it's told by everyone. I can't tell you how great it was to listen to the audiobook where every single one of these people was telling their story. Tom tells a great story about how they were able to get everyone to do the audiobook part. So without further ado, let's talk to my dear friend, music fan, music industry veteran, podcaster, and now author, my pal Tom DeSavia. Let's get down. Congratulations on this book.
Thank you, brother.
It is weird. It is weird. It was a big surprise, but like your fandom has been something that's always stood out to me. And like in my experience in the big music business, you were a guy that I always thought of as like one of us. You know what I mean?
Right on. That's a fucking awesome compliment.
Well, you can kind of tell by the company you keep and everything.
Well, some of them.
Some of them.
some might cause more judgments than others.
Yeah. So how are you doing? Are you doing good?
I'm good, brother, man. Good to see you, man. It's
good to see you. You can see me?
Yeah, can you not see me?
No, I can't see you. It's just some weird thuggish looking photo.
Oh, wait. Here we go.
There you are. All right.
I was wondering why you weren't looking. I thought you just like got like a little snootier these days.
Yeah, I'm a jerk, kind of.
Yeah, so dude is kind of looking off.
Yeah, I don't give a fuck anymore.
Fuck you.
Congratulations on the podcast. Congratulations on the book.
Thanks, dude. So
tell me, I don't even know where to start exactly. I've got so many things to ask you.
How the hell are you doing?
I'm doing great. I am doing very well. I'm playing a lot with the band Skyrocket that I'm in. I'm doing a lot of this. Podcasting. I'm doing a lot of songwriting with people and on my own. Been doing a bunch of stuff with Einar from Gaudi, which has been fun. Yeah. Yeah, he's doing great. He's here. And we're actually going to write tomorrow.
That's fucking A, right on.
Yeah.
Oh, that makes me happy.
Yeah.
How long have you two been like doing shit again?
Well,
have you ever stopped?
Well, we always kind of got together and hung out, but he's been so busy with Kelly Clarkson and doing other stuff.
He was living here.
He was. He moved back here like 5 years ago or 6 years
ago. Yeah, I was going to say, because I think the last time I saw him, he was still here.
Yeah.
So he's been back there like 5 years now?
Yeah.
And he has a couple of kids, right?
He's got two kids. Yeah. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Say hey for me.
I will. I definitely will.
Right on.
I'll tell him tomorrow. So I saw that you guys did a thing at the Grammy Museum this weekend.
Yeah.
How was that?
It was really fun. We did actually two events this week or last week. We did a thing at the LA Public Library where John and Xene were interviewed and did like a couple of acoustic songs. And then we had a bunch of the guest authors and photographers came down and signed some books. And we did the same thing on Wednesday at the Grammy Museum. But there I actually moderated the discussion, basically interviewed John and Sheila Caffey, which was just a fucking blast, which was just amazing.
That sounds awesome.
And and then afterwards, John did probably a half-hour set. Probably a half-hour set for the crowd. And then the same thing, we had about, I think about 8 or 10 of the guest authors. So Jane Wiedlin was there, Ed Culver, Jenny Lenz. We had some amazing people that were there just signing as well and stuff. So we had like this sort of assembly line of books and everyone came up really enthusiastic. And then every like third person because I was sitting at the very front of the autograph line.
Yeah.
Every third person would sort of look at that, this whole line of amazing punk rock legends just sitting there, and then look a little disappointed when they saw me at the front of the line and trying to figure out how they could skip over me with their books. Whenever I saw that moment happen, I just made sure I didn't create eye contact, not to cause awkwardness, because they'd just be looking down this line and going, look, there's John Doe sitting next to Charlotte Caffey and Jane Wedlin and Ed Culver. And, oh, there's that guy. I'm just going to let him, and we'd just be that awkward, like not trying to make eye contact with me. We pretend it didn't happen.
Well, it's I had an interesting experience with your name being said by Terry Gross on Fresh Air when I was driving home the other day. I was just like, I know that guy. She's saying his name. Have you ever met her?
I never met her. That was kind of fun, though.
Shit, that is awesome.
That was pretty cool. I went down. It was funny because I went down to the studio that morning and just to see, and I got a couple of books signed. So I just saw like Exene and John and Dave, but she wasn't there, of course. So it was just done remotely. So I got there at the beginning when they were just about to go start taping, but they were just in a remote studio ready to go live. So I never got to meet her, but it was. I got a bunch of calls definitely that day. Go, Terry Gross just said your name.
Well, people, I mean, I'm sure they're proud. So, man, this all starts with you seeing X when you were 15.
Mm-hmm.
What was, will you paint me what your life was like before you went to that concert that day?
Oh, it wasn't, it was
or that
awkward.
Show.
It was awkward like every 15-year-old boy. What was funny, it's the thing about that show that I remember the most was I'd been going to concerts like that year, my 15th year, and I want to say this was probably in the fall. I should look up to see actually when the show happened, but it was later in the year. But that was the year that I really started to go like to clubs. Before that, I was going to shows from when I was pretty young because my brother and sister were 12 and 14 years older than me, and so we'd go to like a lot of arena shows, and we were going to the Rose Bowl once when I was maybe like 13. See, like a bunch of like those big rock shows. But I started going to club shows when I was probably 15, and it was a lot of like the new wave stuff we heard on the radio. It was like K-Rock, the local station, who would promote a lot of shows. So we'd go see like, you know, Stray Cats or whoever was like, those kind of shows. And so I'd start to get into punk through these friends I had in school, and then met these two guys working at this record store named Lance and Jeff that worked at this cool record store called Blue Meanie out here, and they were guys that were actually going to punk shows. And so I'd been to, like I said, some of these new wave shows, and at this one particular location, it was a place called the Country Club in Reseda, California. It was an old like drugstore that was converted into an all-ages club. And I'd seen some new wave stuff there, and it was very much kind of like going to a, you know.
Like the Knack or something? Or
yeah, no, I just went to go see these bands, and it was like going to a club show. It was cooler than going to an arena, but it was just going to a club show, so we've been to a few of those. So the day I went to my first punk show, which was an X show, I vividly remember had this Argyle sweater that I'd recently got that I had worn to the Stray Cat show at the Palladium like earlier that year. And I was like, all right, I'll put on this. And I just dressed wrong. I just dressed like an idiot. And I walked into this room and it was nothing like anything I'd ever seen before. It was like hell. And I was like, oh fuck. Can I say fuck?
Yeah.
Your podcast?
Yeah.
Okay. Fuck. And, wasn't sure how I was going to make it through this thing. Everyone was staring at me, and not that like, oh, I'm sure they weren't staring at you. No, they were staring at me. I looked totally out of place. I went with my friends who looked totally in place, which is just they just looked cooler, and they had like t-shirts and jeans, and I was a scrawny, like weird looking kid in this Argyle sweater. So I went to the, and nothing was. It was just fucking maddening in there. There was these. They were sort of noise in between songs, but there wasn't like proper clapping.
And there was a
mosh pit, and it was really freaky. So I was just remember, I've said this a bunch, but it's true. Because I remember the feeling. You could kind of vividly remember people and stuff. I remember pushing myself into the back wall of the club as hard as I could. And I remember like thinking, like, if I could go through this, it would be like awesome. I'd love to be out of here. And then at some point, I just was like watching it. And I remember just the music kind of took over, and I just sort of like stopped being freaked out by my surroundings and just kind of got into it. And it went from that thing of like, you know, get me out of the speeding car and I'll never drive fast again to I like drag racing. It's cool, you know? And so, yeah, so that's a very long way of saying, 15.
So after that, how did you, you ended up having a career in music. Did you ever want to play?
No.
Okay.
No. It's funny. I learned how to play a little guitar when I was a kid. I took guitar lessons for a while, but I was never driven to be an artist. I probably knew I just didn't have natural talent. It wasn't something that was calling to me. It wasn't like I never had the desire to create. I never had the desire to. I remember this moment pretty well too. And I was a pretty little kid. I used to. I started collecting records at a really, really young age because my brother and sister, who were sort of my parents, kind of discouraged them wasting their money on records. They'd buy them for me as sort of a excuse to get records in the house. So by the time I was like probably 6 years old, I had this pretty, you know, awesome collection of like, you know, the Neil Young and the Beatles and the Zeppelin album You Should Have Anyway.
Right.
And I became kind of obsessed, which I still am, with records, and I became a record collector. So every dime, and I would buy them with any spare money I'd have. I would go to the store and I'd either get a single or an album. And I was really proud of them, and I'd lug them around whenever, and I'd always like have them on the floor in front of me, and kind of, I still do it. It's really pathetic, but I still have that thing where I just was like, I was obsessed with my records.
Yeah, yeah.
And so I remember at one point my parents had some of their friends over for like a Sunday barbecue or something. And I was in the living room fawning over all my records. And this guy, I don't even remember who it was, this friend of my folks, I remember saying like, you should get a job in the music industry. Then you get free records. And I was just like, bing. And I was like, it never before occurred to me that there was a job that you have that you would get free records. And so then I was just like, all right, I want to do that. Wasn't quite sure what it was. And then set out to, you know, my dad would take me when I was a little kid, when I was about 9 years old, 10 years old. And every once in a while we'd go to the newsstand, we get to buy Billboard magazine. It's so geeky. Behind this, you know, like every 9 year old buying a trade magazine and just kind of flipping through it and seeing these pictures of these guys that were executives and they were hanging out with all these rock stars. And I'm like, holy shit, they get free records.
Yeah.
They have dinner with these people.
Yeah.
Like, this is great. It's like, you know, hanging out with rock stars but not having to have any talent. And I'm like, I can do that.
So what was your first job then in the business?
So my first job was I wanted to be a journalist. I used to write like record reviews for the school paper. And my best friend, I should go backwards a little bit. So my best friend from when I was 13, who's still my best friend, a guy named Adam Levy, who's an amazing guitarist and spent a lot of time actually in Norah Jones' band. And a variety of other amazing sessions, and is an amazing songwriter, like one of the most soulful guitarists I know, and is an amazing, amazing jazz player. So when we were kids, we were turning each other on to records all the time. He was my record buddy. His grandfather, interestingly, wrote the music to the theme from Gilligan's Island, and it's the most wonderful time of the year.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, proving once again that all great Christmas songs are written by Jews.
Yeah.
But that's the podcast, but it's true, true fact. And so he had a friend that was working at this shitty little trade magazine called Cashbox, which was this long past its prime sort of companion, but not really, to Billboard. And he And I was like, get me an internship. He went to, he was going to a music school with a girl that worked there. And so he called his friend and she gave me an internship. And I remember getting out of 1 day a week internship, but I would go on like every day because I was just like, there's,
you were obsessed.
I was obsessed. It was, yeah, so fucking cool. And I'd drive all the way from Thousand Oaks into Hollywood and I'd be like, I'll do whatever you want. So they had me like, you know, sorting 8x10 glossy photos that were being used for press and all stuff. And I was in there every day and it was literally like about my third or fourth week. And I wasn't doing any writing whatsoever. I was literally just like, you know, filing photos for them or whatever they needed to do, you know, taking out the trash probably. And like the third or the fourth week, the editor, it was a really smallly staffed magazine, and the editor came sort of walking through like in a classic kind of like, you know, old newsroom way. I just came walking through. It was like, oh, my reporter's out sick. I don't know what I've got to do. I've got these stories I got to put in and get written. I don't know who's going to write these stories. And I just, like, you know, the little upstart from the back went, I can do it, mister.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And he gave me a story, and I wrote a story for him. And he liked it. And he's like, all right, try another one. And I wrote another story for him, and then they hired me.
That's awesome.
I got hired like 3 weeks into my internship or 4 weeks into my internship and was writing like just whatever they needed. And I did that for about 3 years when I realized I didn't like, you know, writing for a weekly magazine. I didn't really like being a rock critic. I love music, but I just find I just didn't like being a rock critic. Just didn't feel like, I just was like, it's not my place to tell someone what kind of sandwich to like.
Right.
You know, I just didn't really dig that. And so I didn't know what I wanted to do and I didn't have any skills or talents or, you know, anything to really contribute to society. So I stayed in the business. Forgot to go to college. No, I'd gotten a call from a company called ASCAP.
Yeah.
At that point. And they had been reading a column I was writing. Oh, I should mention that I started working at this job. I was about 19, and I worked there till I was 21. And by the time I was 21, I went from being the intern to being West Coast editor.
Wow!
And that happened, before you say wow, that didn't happen because I was some kind of wonderkind, amazing talent. It was just like people would quit this job so often. There's such high turnover that every time someone would quit, the old boss, who was sort of this classic crotchety old guy, came in and was like, you want to do the job? No more money. I'm like, okay. So literally, I just, for like in less than 3 years, I'm from intern to West Coast editor with probably getting all of a $500 pay raise in that time. But I was like, I'll do it. I'll do it. I'll do it. And so I wound up having this really amazing title only because I would do the job cheap every time someone would quit and would never raise. And then anyway, I got a call from ASCAP, and I didn't know what ASCAP was. I thought it was like the bank. And they called and said they were reading this column I was writing on unsigned bands and using it to scout bands. Would I like to come and talk to them about a job? I didn't know what they were. And so I think I said, no, thank you. It's real nice. And I hung up. And then someone I worked with knew someone that worked there. And he's like, that place is kind of cool. And they get really involved with songwriters early on. And the guy whose job they're going to hire for became an A&R guy. In a year. And I decided I wanted to be an A&R guy at that point, I think. And I was like, yeah, I want to do that next. You know, just kind of like an idiot. You know?
From, sure. But what was your, like, I met you when you were at ASCAP, like I think in 1993 or 94.
Yeah, that's right. Because, yeah, then we started working together in about 96 at Elektra.
Right.
Moved there. But yeah, so I was at ASCAP and I became, the first time I was there, I was working in, I guess, like rock membership. And there was really only like two of us in LA, a guy in Chicago, my friends Mike and Damon, and then I think we had a couple of people in New York that were also kind of doing rock and alternative music. And it was in the early 90s, so it was a, you know, it was a great time,
yeah,
for rock and alternative music. And our job was to sign them up and to provide kind of services that to help out these writers. So we started to do showcases,
right.
And that's when we started the ASCAP showcase idea. We started, like, you know, going around. I always said the best time I had, and probably the most, like, fun I had in the music business was when I didn't know there were rules and stuff you're supposed to do and not supposed to do.
Right.
And so we were just, like, walking to record companies with people's, these, you know, just music from different bands we'd like, and be like, you should sign these guys. And all these bands started getting assigned. And, you know, same thing with publishers. And they're sort of using Best at ASCAP as kind of like, you know, almost like a scouts. We're just turning on labels and publishers to all this stuff. And then I liked the idea of, and then I was going into the studio a lot. And even though I never set out to be a musician, I fell in love with going into the studio, and I fell in love with the creation process.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, I want to do that, but I didn't know how to go about it. So me and this buddy Mike Badamy, that I used to work at ASCAP with, we started a little 7-inch label.
Oh, really?
We just started to put out records.
Oh,
yeah.
Awesome.
And we didn't know. And again, the only thing we put out of note was we put out the first single by the Presidents of the United States of America.
Oh, no shit.
Yeah. We put out.
What was that, Lump or something? No.
It was called Naked and Famous. And the flip side was called Puffy Little Shoes, I think. I don't know what year it was, but yeah. And it was, we were spending all this money colored vinyl and doing it up, and of course not making any money. That one sold pretty well. We put out a bunch of records, and then I started to get calls. We both did. We started to get calls to go to a record company or publishing company. And then a very long, boring, you know, a few months later, I wound up at Elektra, which is where I met you.
Yeah. No, I met you when you were at ASCAP, when I was in Mr. Rockabilly. No, yeah.
Officially, yeah, that's right.
Right.
So, yeah, no, but I mentioned the ASCAP days, but...
So the magic happens is you signed X when you were there.
Well, so
no.
Not really. Well, sort of what happened was when I was, like, it was in this magical time of the music business where there was more than one label in the world, so... There was a few offers to go, like, as an executive. And there was a couple of choices of different labels to go to. And I was kind of obsessed with Elektra Records because some of my favorite artists had been on Elektra, spanning from Unapologetically X to Linda Ronstadt and, you know, MC5 and Billy Bragg and all this amazing college rock that came out in those early days to... The Pixies to Bjork. Like, it was just this label that artistically I loved. And so when they offered the gig, I went in there and I said, I knew I wanted to go work there. And I met with this amazing record man named Seymour Stein.
Wow.
And a woman named Nancy Jeffries, who you probably remember.
Yeah, I remember her.
Who's running A&R on the Elektra side. And they are both just, you know, these amazingly artistic, wonderful people. And I remember saying, well, I'll take the job if I could do an Xbox set. And
they were okay.
They were like, okay. And so then at that point, then we did X Anthology, and that's how I met the band and specifically John.
And then you ended up, like, when did you get the idea for this book?
Well, it's funny. We've been talking about this a lot lately. So when we did the box set, which we started working on it, that was 96. And John and I started to get along pretty well. And like I said, I'd been going to see him play since I was 15. And, you know, they were just my favorite band. And
what is that feeling like to get to work on a box set with the band that flipped your switch? You know what I mean?
Oh, my God. It was fucking awesome. You know, what does it feel like to get to go through the tape vaults and listen to everything that was in there? And it was
just
like...
Yeah. I was making the hair on my arm stand up.
Oh, yeah. My head was exploding. It was... And they were real nice, too. They're all real nice, which, you know, sometimes you don't want to meet the musicians or the artists or the authors or the painters you love because if they're dicks, you're really bummed out. And they were real nice, but yeah, it was just like going through shit tons of stuff. I mean, we went through so much stuff. And while we're at it, so John, I probably spent the most time with John, or I definitely spent the most time with John during that time. And you know, the band was super active in this set. It wasn't like me putting it together and going, what do you think, guys? Like, everyone was really involved in it. Billy Zoom came back into the fold at that time. It sort of spurned them reuniting and going on tour again. And but we had told John and I had started to hang out rather, and we'd like go to lunch or dinner, and you know, I was trying to be really cool, and I'd start like asking him questions about like, oh, I heard about this time that, you know, Darby Crash and Jane Wiedlin, blah 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 blah, and I'd tell some story I heard, and he's like, I don't think that ever happened. I would remember that. I don't remember that. And I'd sort of be disappointed. And then he'd tell me some story that was like 10 times fucking better than whatever story I'd told him.
Right, right.
And so at that point, I started to say, you got to write a book. You got to write a book. And he just wasn't interested. He was like, I don't want to tell my story. He's like, no. And he's like, he just wasn't interested. And so literally for 20 years, I was bugging him as, you know, was John's amazing girlfriend, and I'm sure a lot of people in his life. He didn't want to do it. And then about 2-3 years ago, we came up with this concept to tell the story in a lot of voices.
Yeah.
And that's when he was like, oh, I'd do that. And he's like, all right, let's try it. And that's how it came out.
Yeah, you know, the beautiful thing about it, having listened to it on the audiobook version, is that you did get all the voices.
We got all of them. There's a guy named Scott Sherritt. I got to give him a shout out. Really amazing guy who, he's a, you know, a really talented producer, and he's found this really great life as sort of the king of the audiobooks, and that's who he does. But he's you can tell he's a musician. You can tell he loves music because he approached these sessions like a producer.
Right.
Would really direct him, got him together. But we got connected with him through our agent, a woman named Lynn Johnson, who we were very lucky to meet, who got us our deals. And she was like, there's this guy who does audiobooks and you should meet him. And we talked to him, and he was, you know, as much a fan as any of us were with this kind of music, and really busy cat doing a ton of audiobooks. And he was like, God, I would love to do this audiobook. We wound up, you know, spearheaded by he and Lynn. We wound up doing a deal because the book is out on DeCapo Hachette, or Hachette, uh-huh. I believe they pronounce it. And the audiobooks through Penguin Random House was a separate deal. And all I did one day was I literally got on an email with every contributor, and I said, Dear Mike Watt, this is Scott Sherritt. He's going to do the audiobook for us. And he managed in a 3-day period to get almost all the authors into the studio on this amazing schedule, like an hour each over like 3 days. We got everyone except Jane Wiedlin, who had to do hers from San Francisco, and Billy Joe Armstrong, who read his forward from San Francisco. Everything else he did that day, which was insane.
That's...
So it happened because this guy like wanted it to exist and just kicked ass.
Well, I have to tell you that, I mean, I don't know what it would have sounded like with just some guy that, you know, like just some reader guy, you know, that they hire for them. It really made a huge difference to have all those voices and all those characters coming to life. And I have to say this one thing, like my experience with that music, like I wasn't like really a punk guy.
Right.
My experience with that scene mostly comes from Weird Kids t-shirts, like homemade t-shirts.
Yep.
And then seeing The Decline of Western Civilization Part 1, like on cable late at night at a friend of mine's house with a bunch of people. And there's something about, it's scary. When you see that movie, it's scary. It's all like there, and it's happening at the time. And the beauty of this book is that you get that space between the time that these guys were living that insane kind of life to where they can see all the beauty in it and what they You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, absolutely.
Like there's something a little softer about the way they're telling, like you're hearing the stories now.
Right.
Even though they're still real and stuff, you don't have that intensely raw thing that was happening that makes you so uncomfortable in the moment while it's happening, like you do with Western Civilization, the Decline of Western Civilization one.
Yeah, well, I think everyone, I mean, you know, I can't speak for them because I was, you know, I was too young to be a part of that first wave. I mean, this book sort of ends kind of like, you know, I realized like where the book kind of ends and, you know, kind of says, you know, like in its own way, like, okay, so this first wave of the first real punk movement on the West Coast in Los Angeles is kind of like fractioning out a bit. You know, all of a sudden you've got the hardcore bands going on the road. You've got right. the bands on the verge. Slash Records about to do a, you know, a deal with Warner Brothers. And so you got like all of a sudden it's growing. And that's sort of when me and my friends came in. We're like, hello.
Yeah.
You know, we came to the end of it. So it's this first part. And what was really great is like that, you know, there was that sense of camaraderie that I'd hoped existed. The stuff that was true was all the stuff you want to, that they were all like really supportive of each other and actually really trying to make it and really trying to be musicians.
Yeah.
And when I say make it, but on their terms and being really artistically pure. But, you know, like there was something that one of the first things, it was funny that John ever said to me, and I remember it kind of kicked in when we were just starting about one of the things that I was like, I wanted to talk about this in the book. And this was all those years ago, was something came up about the Go-Go's. And he said, oh, I remember the first time we saw him, like at the Mask, and you know, we knew those girls were going to have hits. We knew those were hit songs. And I remember just going like, you did? That's weird. Like, I wouldn't think like that right. would be your thought process at the time that you would even think in those terms. It's like, oh no, everyone knew these were hits. And then I remember that always stuck with me. And that was something I was always like, so that's the kind of thing that's got to be written in a book. Yada, yada.
Yeah.
And then we were at the library event the other day, and Charlotte Caffey from the Go-Go's came down, and John recounted that story, and later she was like, you really thought we had hits? Like, it was like, I didn't know that each other. and it was kind of, it was just cool to me that there was like, and there was this band, the Go-Go's, that not many people knew, not only came from that era, but were authentic
right.
punk rockers. I mean,
right.
not just like hanging out on the scene, they were authentic, but they became the first to have real mainstream, and the only really to have that kind of mainstream success until, you know, you take a band like Los Lobos years later.
Right. That was an interesting chapter too, the one that you talked about the Latino movement that was going on. And then Robert Lopez, Elvez, who I didn't realize that he was from that scene. I just knew him like from the 90s as Elvez.
Right. No, totally. And it was funny because Teresa from The Brat, who wrote the East LA chapter, who was spanned, you know, just loved that band when I was younger, and you know, I bought they had a little 10-inch EP. I bought it just because Xene did the lettering. You know, she has that real cool way of writing.
Yeah,
and so I just recognized her, and I bought it for that. And I'm like, this was cool. But I remember it was through that scene, because we're pretty young, that you became aware of, like, not only was there a scene that was like, you know, a real Mexican American scene in taking place at a certain part of town, but it kind of had its own sound. It had its own feel. And it was a movement within punk rock. I mean, punk rock contained so many elements of roots and Latin music and things that, you know, people don't think of right off the bat. I mean, you might, you know, it was rockabilly. It was really this amalgamation of so many, it's just a giant melting pot.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's great music, but the Latin scene was just amazing. The East LA scene was incredible.
And it seems like sorry, there's a weird echo. That the new sincerity movement that came afterwards, I guess, whatever the first wave of Americana, is that what you would call that?
I'm sure everyone had this called cowpunk.
Right. Cowpunk. Exactly. Like rank and file and that kind of stuff. The Alejandro and Javier were doing was Tony Gilkison an ex before he was in Lone Justice, or was that?
Oh, he was in Lone Justice. And then he was an ex.
Okay.
And yeah, we were all Lone Justice freaks too. We all had crushes on Marie McKee.
Yeah,
for sure.
She's amazing. That first record was really like, I remember when it came out, like it was like a new sound. You know what I mean? Check it out. This is like, you know, this is going on.
Well, and it was funny because X about that time was, and actually even before that was doing a band called The Knitters, which was Dave Alvin and a couple other players. And it was them stretching out and doing basically their country band. I always say I grew up because my pop, he liked a lot of country records. And those were the records like I'd hide when my friends would come over because it wasn't okay to have country records really. And then when we started to go like, well, it's cool enough for these bands too. It was like that thing that let's take those, you know, it sounds funny to say, but like, you know, that you wouldn't be more than proud to have a George Jones record in your house. But I remember it was like these aren't cool.
Yeah.
My friends were like, so George and Tammy's Greatest Hits stayed hidden in the closet until sort of the punk rock guys came around and gals and said, you know, it's okay to listen to stuff.
Did you continue listening to like your, big rock band records after you started listening to punk, or did you do? Because I remember there was a big division.
Yeah, I never listened to what happened with these. So I always had this stuff that I listened to always. Like, you know, I loved the country rock stuff. I loved the, you know, like Graham Parsons and Linda Ronstadt.
Right, right.
And loved all that stuff so much. And I loved, like, you know, stuff we all loved, you know, just like, you know, there's certainly like, you know, big hits or big records that were out. But the thing I missed completely was, and then when I got into punk rock, and I liked a lot of new wave stuff, and I liked a lot of the, you know, just alternative stuff that was happening. But the only real division was metal.
Right.
And so, you know, you basically only heard the records that your buddies had. And there's this real like line in the sand drawn between punk and metal.
Yeah.
And, you know, it seemed to me, you know, the thing wasn't among, you know, a bunch of idiots that we all hung out with and a bunch of idiots in LA in general, that you couldn't listen to metal and you couldn't listen to punk. And they used to dress different, and, you know, the metal guys were all in their Rush t-shirts with really long hair, wearing leather studded caps, and the punk kids were in, you know, jeans and t-shirts and whatever clown makeup they were wearing. I never sort of dressed any part, but I just decided, well, fuck metal. I don't know metal. And it's funny because you were actually there for part of this, if I could recount some of our personal history. So I was just like, I don't like metal.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah, I don't like it. I don't know it. And, you know, all I knew of metal were, you know, the whatever hits came over MTV, you know, but wasn't really metal. And then when I started working with Lars Ulrich in the 90s, who signed
my band, yeah.
One night, I don't know if you remember, it was one of the first nights I hung out with Lars. We were in New York and we were at the Whiskey Bar.
Yeah.
Do you remember this night?
Yeah, totally. I'm nervous about what you're going to say.
Oh, no. There's many things from this night that I won't repeat.
Okay.
But what the bull said was, at one point, it was the first time, yeah, I'm not going to, I know what stories you're thinking
about. I think I'm turning red.
All
right.
I'm sitting there with Lars, and we're standing outside, and I was probably smoking a cigarette, and I hadn't really gotten to know him well. And I was there, I think, with Gina and Dan, DeMaria and McCarroll, and we're all standing outside, and probably a couple of you guys. And Lars kind of says to me, he's like, and I was their liaison at Elektra, if you remember. Like, I was sort of the guy, you know, at Elektra, and then you guys were all doing the music company thing. They were down the hall, so I was sort of that. And
right.
So I never really listened to Metallica, and so Lars, I mean, he was like, so, man, you really excited to be working on this? I'm like, yeah, this is great. He's like, yeah. He's like, you big Metallica fan? I'm like, yeah.
Oh, no.
He's like, and he could kind of tell, I think. I was kind of hesitant, but I didn't know what to say. And he was like, you know, what's your favorite Metallica song? And I was like, Enter Sandman. And then he kind of looked at me and he's like, what's your next favorite song? And using you know, humor as a defense mechanism, as I always have done, and stupidly many points in my life, I said Sister Christian, and I thought it would be really funny. And he started laughing. He's like, you don't know my band, do you? And I went, no, I was stumbling. I'm sitting there going, fuck, I'm going to get fired because I've insulted Lars from like the biggest band in the world. And he liked that I didn't know metal.
I was worried about that same thing. And then I noticed that he actually kind of liked it.
He liked it. Yeah. He liked that we weren't like, and so he sent me a box. I got back home and he sent me a box of CDs. And it was like, you know, Merciful Fate CDs and, you know, like all these like metal bands. And it was like, you need to learn metal. And so I started to listen to metal. And then at the same time, I had two good buddies, my friend Michael Ward, who's a great guitarist, and my buddy Matt Messer, who are just two friends I hang out with. And they were both like, and Joe, a guy named Joe Fleischer, were all playing me metal music and started to play me these bands called Motorhead and Iron Maiden.
Oh, yeah.
Like in the 90s, you know, and I was like, you guys, this shit's great. You know, why is everybody listening to this stuff? And that's when I realized I actually did like a lot of metal, but I completely missed it.
Yeah, I missed it too. I think that's what there was. I had the way that I avoided it was, I remember I had this friend named Kevin Daniels who lived at the end of my street in the Woodlands. And he used to get him and his musician guys used to sit in there, and one guy would get behind the drums and play Tom Sawyer. Another guy would play, like, you know, the solo from Crazy Train on guitar. But all the girls that hung out were just like skanked out. And then I noticed that like the really hot chicks at school were all listening to like Duran Duran and stuff. And I was like, all right, I'm going to go over here because it's going to work out a little better for me. Or at least I think so.
It's so funny. Yeah, all that stuff that you only like now, you know, you can listen to whatever you want. It's great. But then you only heard what the peer group you decided to hang out with had.
Yeah, exactly. Hey, you know what I wanted to mention about the book that I think is really amazing and I think comes out when you tell stories about these scenes and stuff is the city itself is such a big character in the book.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like just like it is. The layout of the city and where the people lived and how they lived. It's pretty amazing.
Well, it was funny. I mean, that was the whole thing was like, you know, it was in the time of regionalism, you know, before there was a Starbucks on every corner and everyone had, you know, the same Target down the street or the same, you know, it was. And so, you know, whenever there's real regionalism, which is probably only truly left in towns that have, sadly, like real strong areas of like racial divide, like, you know, Memphis and New Orleans, because then you hold on to a certain kind of artistic culture and it gets more preserved because people are less interested in profiting off it and bulldozing it to put up a Starbucks, you know.
Right.
But it wasn't that long ago before, you know, that radio was deregulated and it became, you know, what is Randy Newman, One Giant America Town. You know, it all became the same stuff. There was, you know, a sound for each area. I mean, you know, there's an Austin punk rock scene that sounded like the influence there. And so there's so much of the LA stuff, that I think just is influenced by the surroundings and, you know, not just lyrically, but, you know, you're making music in a different way. I think if it's beautiful 70 degrees weather out all the time, but you're poor as shit.
you know?
So it's like, and combating, like they said, the whole sort of over the top cocaine Eagles lifestyle that the rest of the world assumed was all LA was about, you know?
Right. So before I let you go, I wanted to talk to you a bit about Live from High Fidelity. Great podcast.
Yes.
And tell your friend Greg that today I was listening to Donny Hathaway and Roberta Flack, that album, this morning before I listened to your podcast this afternoon. It was weird.
No way.
Yeah, and then I was totally shocked that John Bryan had never really listened to that whole record.
Well, do you have it? I'm sure that was Eric had that record.
Eric, sorry.
And no, sorry, it was Eric Gorfain, the amazing violinist and leader of the string quartet, the section quartet. But it was funny. I'm always amazed. So we had John Brown on. We'd taken about a year off from doing the podcast. Right. One, Eric was in the middle of a ton of projects. I was working on the book, and we were just like, let's regroup when things slow down. So we did it with John Brian. And I'm just amazed when John doesn't know any record. Yeah. I thought John knew every record that, right. And I'm still not convinced he doesn't. I think he just tries to make mortals feel better. And everyone's all pretends he doesn't know one, just so you can feel kind of like I'm playing John Brian. So.
That's hilarious. So are you guys picking it back up now? It's going to be,
yeah.
Okay. All right, yeah, back on schedule.
We're picking it back up. We're sort of just back at it. It was funny. It's like, you know, we fell off it for about a year. This is our 32nd, I think, episode we did. And it was one of those things. It's, you know, I assume it's the equivalent of like when you get together and play with a bunch of musicians after you haven't played in a while and you're like, oh, right. This is why we play together. And,
yeah.
And it was like, it was just really fun when we left. We had a really good time. And because it was John, though, we did an unusual thing, which we started taping it at about 12:30 at night over at Largo after one of his shows. We had a room full of people, and we had a whole bunch of Guinness. And so I haven't listened to the episode yet, but I got to assume at the end, it's probably getting a little loud and a little sloppy because I was probably about four Guinnesses in by the time we were done, just drinking my chocolate beer and getting bombed and listening to
Played a lot of Prince.
Well, yeah. A lot of Prince.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a big loss.
Oh man. That one.
It's been a constant, like a stream of losses.
Damn it, man. Lately. This shit fucking sucks.
Yeah.
It's weird. I was saying to someone just yesterday, I go, the Prince one hit me harder than one I expected. And two, and I mean this with zero disrespect at all, but it hit me harder than the Bowie one too. And as much as the Bowie thing just, I've never seen, you know, probably, you know, because of, you know, social media and everything, you got the scope on when a loss like that happens, how it affects right. the world, you know, and it was just amazing and, you know, beautiful and sad and heartbreaking watching the Bowie thing unfold in front of us. But I think in a weird way, like I had heard Bowie was sick about a year before, 2 years before when he put out the album prior.
Right.
I didn't know what it was or how serious it was. And by the time I was growing up, Bowie, the only new Bowie stuff that came out when I was a kid that was on the radio would have been Let's Dance and China Girl.
Yeah.
Blue Jean, those records. So all those early hits were already just in the air. It was already...
Right, classic rock.
Yeah. Yeah. And so it was big. But with Prince, those were...
Yeah.
I remember when those were on the radio.
Yeah.
It's what I imagine it would have been like when the Beatles were putting out records and you're going like, oh my God, what's he going to do next?
Yeah.
And, you know, what's it going to sound like? And, you know, like not being a musician, when you said earlier, like it took me a minute when Doves Cry came out, it was like, what's weird about this song?
Yeah. You know? Yeah. What's wrong with my stereo?
All right. There's no bass on this. Or when, yeah, what's that line in, it was in the middle of the, you know, AIDS crisis when, Sign of the Times came out and the song was on top 40 radio. But
France, a skinny man died of a big disease with a little name.
Francis, skinny man died of a big disease with a little name. And it was like soon, not much later, his girlfriend came upon a needle and soon she did the same. And you're like, and it's on the radio.
Yeah.
And it was just like this, and everything he was putting out was just like so mind blowing, I think, for all of us.
Yeah.
And so when he went, it was sort of just that thing that you went like, oh, wow, a little part of sort of what really shaped my ears ended far too young. And it was like, it was fucking hard. That one, like,
No, I know exactly.
Yeah. It struck me down a lot harder than I thought it was. God bless Prince. He was so fucking great.
Yeah. Yeah. So what are you doing now? What's next on the plate for Tom?
It's funny. I was saying, I don't know what it is. I just went out with my publisher today and I really liked the process of doing the book a lot. And to the point that I think I want to do it again. And so I was out with the publisher and we were talking about possible things to do. And they'd probably all be music related or some kind of pop culture related things, and trying to figure out like what the subject is. I would, love someday to write a sequel with John and all the writers on the next sort of the next wave and the final sort of wave of LA punk as we knew it. But that would be a few years away. It's daunting. Like the thought of doing something would be really fun. And I want to write something. It was really great being, the oats to John Doe's.
Yeah.
Oh, Paul.
Yeah.
As it were. Because, just having John, who, everyone wanted to know his story, made it really a great way to write something, because you're with, it's sort of like, in your first movie, you're in with Robert De Niro. You know, you're kind of like, okay, so people are going to go see this movie because Robert De Niro's in it.
Right, right.
so,
they'll read this book because John's in it.
Fuck yeah!
It's totally great.
It was funny. At one point early on, the publicist from the book company called me and just said, hey, we just want to make sure it's okay. Some of the press people might not want to talk to you. I'm like, no, duh.
Yeah.
I wouldn't want to talk to me. I'd want to talk to those guys. So trying to think of something interesting to write that's something I could tackle on my own now, and I'll probably, like, no matter what it is, try to get John to do it with me just because it was so much fun.
Yeah. With him.
Well, so man, I'll try to get him to write a book on like something he has no desire in.
Can write a book. Everybody seemed to slam the fucking Love Boat in that book too.
Yeah,
I was like, really? I was like, man, guys, I was loving the Love Boat when I was a kid.
Yeah, no, it was all that. And Farrah Fawcett, the major, not minor.
Yeah,
took some shots. Poor Farrah, rest in peace.
Farrah Fawcett minor, by the way, is my favorite name in the book, because everybody has great names, but hers is really the best. Every time it was said, I just started laughing.
My favorite story too is like everyone had punk names in that scene, and you take X specifically, and you have John Doe,
great name,
Sean Cervenka, Billy Zoom, all great punk names. The drummer DJ Bonebreak, that's actually his name.
Oh, really?
His name is Donald John Bonebreak.
Wow.
Of the Bonebreaks, like there's a Mr. Bonebreak and a Mr. Bonebreak, a sibling Bonebreak, or many of them. I don't know, but yeah. So he is. I just think it's and that's always been one of my favorite things, that the arguably the best punk drummer in the world's God given name is Bonebreak.
Yeah,
you get more beautiful than that, right?
Yeah. Hey, you're friends with Jesse Dayton, right?
Yeah, I love
he
Jesse.
He played with them this year. That was sad that Billy couldn't make it, but it was good to see Jesse doing that. That was exciting.
It was good. Well, it was Jesse, because Jesse had done a bunch of shows with John, and John just loves him. And I've known, I met Jesse years and years ago because his wife, Emily.
Yeah.
She had Emily Kay.
The record company. Little,
yeah. So she had a record, and she was at, I think, A&M Records when we were kids. And so we kind of, like, when I was telling you about those early days of starting out, she was one of the kids we were all running around in a stupid little wolf pack. And Emily Kay was like, just, is the coolest woman ever. And so when we kind of reconnected, when John started having Jesse play with him.
Right.
And then, when Billy couldn't go out on that run, I think it was just the easiest decision all of them made. They were like, just get Jesse Jayden to do it. And I was like, what a cool gig to go be an ex for a few months.
Yeah, that's amazing. That would be so fun.
And he did a great fucking job of it, dude. It's like, I mean, that was – he he was amazing on those shows. I saw him on a couple of those shows.
Awesome. So maybe a book is next. And
maybe, I don't know. Maybe.
Well, maybe. I have to say, honestly, in my memory bank of dudes that I've crossed paths with in the business, I'm so glad that we've stayed in touch. I've always had an amazing amount of respect for you, and your integrity and your taste in music is great. And I'm glad that there's people like you still out there it and getting the message out.
Back at you, brother. It was funny. There's people you meet and you just sort of like, you know, the universe keeps it so you stay in touch, and I'm glad we did.
Likewise.
And so, and we haven't gotten to, you know, actually do it in 3D, and that's one of the things actually, when everyone slams social media, it's one of the things I actually really like about social media.
Yeah.
Is it does preserve relationships that are 2,000 miles apart, and right. It does allow for you to sort of keep up with people even in a little way.
Yeah, so. especially when you do what we do, that you've got people scattered all over the place. There's no way to really be face to face with everyone all the time, but it is nice to be able to do this from time to time.
Absolutely, man. Yeah.
Well, man, I'm gonna let you go.
Thank you, brother.
But hold on, I'm gonna stop recording and then I'll let it go. But thank you, Tom DeSavio. The book is called "Under the Big Black Sun: A Personal History of LA Punk." John Doe with Tom DeSavio and friends. Also, the podcast is called "Live from High Fidelity." You can find it on iTunes with Eric Gorfain. Sorry, I wrote it down weird. It made it look like it was Greg. All right, latest episode is with the great John Bryan. Thanks, Tom.
Thanks, man.
That was great. Catching up with my old pal Tom DeSavio. I'm so proud of him, man. This book, "Under the Big Black Sun: A Personal History of LA Punk" by John Doe with Tom DeSavio and friends. Fantastic book, man. It's a great way that if you're interested in learning about music scenes and you don't know about this one, this is a great introduction to the history of LA punk, okay? And if you are a fan of that music, you got to get this book, man, especially the audiobook. I cannot stress enough how cool it is to have all of these people tell you their story themselves with their voices in your ears. Fucking awesome, including Tom DeSavio, who's got a great voice, by the way. All right, check out his podcast, Live from High Fidelity. You can find it on iTunes. Tom DeSavio is a fantastic guy. I want to thank him for doing the show. I want to thank him for writing this book, man. I learned a lot. I don't know a lot about that music. I don't know a lot about that scene. What I learned about it, all I know about it is what I saw in the Penelope Spheris film, The Decline of Western Civilization, Part 1, and what we talked about in our conversation, which I will post on our Facebook page. Don't forget to like our Facebook page, How Did I Get Here? You can follow me on Twitter and Instagram. I'm at Johnny Gowdy. I want to thank Tom again for hanging out and talking via Skype. Pick up this book, Under the Big Black Sun, Personal History of LA Punk by John Doe with Tom DeSavio and friends. Fantastic book. All right, thank you so much for listening to the show. Thanks again to Tom, and I hope you have a great week. Let's get down. She